Okay, hello folks at home. Today we're going to do a freebooters. This is kind of an ad hoc freebooters because of reasons. But the first thing we're going to talk about today is Mozilla, beloved company by all and beyond any kind of criticism, have decided to terminate their Mastodon instance. And I think this is a little bit worthy for discussion because, well, I don't know if I follow and am followed by a fair number of people on the Fediverse, and I can probably count on one hand how many times someone with the Mozilla instance has even appeared on my timeline, let alone spoken to me. And I don't entirely know what Mozilla were trying to do with their...
By having it.
Yeah. Like, is it... It just seems like it was something one employee just fired up and then forgot about. Like, it
I mean, before we get into it, I love that you introduced this as this is an ad hoc reboot, as you know, as opposed to all of the other
fully scripted ones. Yeah,
not really planned out.
Yeah, unscripted.
When the news broke, I checked out the Mozilla.social, and it's only got 277 users. It's not like.
I assumed that Mozilla Social was for Mozilla employees.
Yeah, that's what I assumed, but it seems not. It seems it was open registrations, right?
It seems odd. So.
I mean, if it's them just out of the kindness of their hearts, you know, running a Fedi server for people, that's great. But then why should it? Like, it can't cost much for Mozilla.
It can't cost much, but it probably distracts from things, right?
Well, it'd be one person just updating it now and then, and you know, points and more. So what the consensus? Because they didn't give a reason, right, for why they're shutting it down.
I've got the press release here. It says we've made the hard decision to end our experiment with Mozilla.social and will shut down the Mastodon instance on December 17th, 2024. You can continue to use Mozilla.social until December 17th. Before that date, you can download your data here and migrate your account to another instance following the instructions below. What will happen on December 17th? The Mozilla.social Mastodon instance will be shut down and all content and accounts will no longer be accessible. Your Mozilla account will remain active for access to other Mozilla products and services. So your Mozilla account will remain active for access to other Mozilla products. So I could log in with my Firefox Sync account?
I don't think so, no. That cannot possibly be true. No, but they make it sound like your Mozilla.social Mastodon account cannot possibly be shared with anything else, can it? When I say possibly, it could, of course, they could have done it that way, but I don't think they did.
I don't think there's anything that's linked to it.
Going back, they didn't give a reason. There's no reason in that. Also, first of all, why does everything have to be a fucking experiment? There's no experiment there. What are you looking to find out? What new information? It's not an experiment.
I suppose the experiment is to see if people use it, but then like just firing it up and leaving it
I barely knew it existed. I remember when they were shutting down, I was like, oh yeah, I remember hearing something about it.
Yeah, but like it's not... I didn't even know if their instance was for like employees. It could have been an experiment, like, or just like it's a presence on there that they're self hosting.
Let's put aside, we'll do the criticisms of Mozilla as a corporation and a foundation later, right? Putting that aside, let's pretend they're just an open, you know, a free software open source company. Like a big free software project having a presence on there and just being like, you know, not like our devs have to have a Mozilla.social account, but you know, it's for our devs and it's for, you know, promoting Firefox, and if anybody is a fan of Mozilla, they can join the instance. That's cool. That's a good idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, no, for shutting it down, and the community consensus and the replies and stuff seems to be it was because Fedi was so critical of the AI stuff.
Which isn't confirmed
in any way, but it seems plausible that they were just like, well, fuck this place. If everybody on this place hates us and hates what we're doing and hates AI, then we'll just get out of here.
See, that actually kind of, in some ways, is a bit more, it makes a bit of sense. Like, if it's only got a couple of hundred users, maybe it's like closed registrations or something. I don't even know. But like with it could easily have been like, why are they not using that Mozilla.social as their own presence on the internet, right? If they're like, if they have anything to do with like the free and social web, as they say, surely they should maybe not necessarily host an instance, but at least have a presence on their own self-hosted one. But
Integrate it. I don't know if this would make sense, but integrate it into the browser somehow. Like they seem to like doing these sidebar-y things now. That's where they're sticking the AI stuff, as I understand it. Like, you know, have a little. I know there's a very minimal Mastodon client that you can use. I forget what it's called now. I was looking at it the other day, but so it's another website you go to and you sign in with your Mastodon account, and then it's a different interface. You know, it's a different client for Mastodon. And it's very minimal. And somebody was saying that would fit nicely in a sidebar. So, you know, integrate Mastodon into that. I mean, I wouldn't want that, but that, you know, that would be a more interesting direction for them to go in, as far as I'm concerned, you know, than like AI or Pocket or all the stupid shit they do.
It's hard to watch, and you're seeing them just hurt themselves. It's the meme of the horses sticking the stick in the spokes of their.
I mean, I see the logic because they're. At least as they're presenting it, like their AI is more like, because they're on the side that says like AI might be a good thing, a useful tool, but it should be self-hosted. Like people should have their own model running. It shouldn't be remote. It shouldn't be in the cloud. So their plan was to have you have a local language model running, and that provides all your AI answers. You're not going to the cloud for it, and that is a healthier version of AI. Like that kind of Mozilla being good, but. I think they're always just, it's the same with Canonical when they're with Ubuntu. They just seem to be like 6 months behind the curve.
Yeah, that's the irritating thing.
Now we're at the point where everybody's pretty much, you know, decided that like this kind of AI, you know, the language model chatbot type AI stuff is not a good, you know, for multiple reasons. You know, the cannibalization of people's creativity is one thing, the reduction of everything to, you know, content, the slop is another thing. And of course, the power use, which is,
Yeah, because of course Microsoft are now firing up a new nuclear power station to power the AI stuff.
That's dystopia shit. For something we don't need, and is you know, arguable benefit at best.
It's that's why the AI bubble is kind of bursting, because a lot of the companies that put the money into it have not seen any kind of like widespread benefit. Because the thing is, it's you can't trust anything that comes out of AI, and I don't know if you ever will. You know, like it can give you something, and then you can check it. But I don't think you could ever, like, I don't know. I'd be interested to say maybe, well, not in real life, like hypothetically, read a book written by AI and see where the worst bit is in a whole book, like where it trips over itself the most.
Yeah,
I wonder if there'd be plot holes. There probably would. Do you think there'd be plot holes? Probably.
Yeah, I think there'd be plot. Is, I mean, this is the very sort of like, it's not literally the first generation, it's gone through some iterations, but we are, you know, this is the, what's the word, like, this is the forefront, like, this is a new thing, this kind of AI, really. And we can train it to be better. You could probably, you know, given, you know, 5 years, you could probably train a language model to write a novel that wouldn't have plot holes, that wouldn't have those kind of telltale signs of being AI. But even then, I mean, we kind of talked about this before, but even then, what is the benefit? This is, you know, this is a trope, a commonly repeated thing on Fedi in particular, but like the point of automation should be automate the mundane things that are boring for people to do, not automate the, you know, our creative things that we enjoy.
Yeah, but also one of the things about jobs and hiring people, for a lot of jobs that require people to do them, that requirement is either like is a responsibility, and a computer can't ever be responsible, right? So so there is only like a limited amount of use it will ever get out of it, because someone will still need to take responsibility for it, fundamentally operated, as it were. I think there could be some great uses for AI theoretically. Like, it would be interesting to see how maybe an independent film studio might be able to use AI to get like Hollywood style special effects and see what that throws.
You know, and also, I mean, I know people are very like illustrators in particular are worried that, you know, it's going to take away their work, you know, if people can just use an AI to generate images. But you know, it's, at the same time, somebody writing their own, I don't know, they're doing some kind of project where they need, you know, making an RPG or something, and they could not possibly afford to hire an illustrator, but you can get something almost as good from an AI, so it lowers the bar of entry to creative endeavors, and I think that's a good thing. The fact that illustrators are potentially, I don't, first of all, I don't think illustrators are going to, well, maybe I think it's going to be more at the bottom end, where people who couldn't have afforded illustrators anyway are just going to use this stuff. I don't think it's going to be people who can afford illustration are still going to want quality illustration for the most part, I would think. I might be wrong. But even then, even if it takes the work, you know, off of illustrators, that's a problem with how we pay people for work. That's not a problem with AI as such. Like, if this stuff does have uses, then we shouldn't sort of blanket rule it out. But what we've got at the moment, from what I can tell, it's only the only thing it's good at, and even then you have to check it, like you say, is summarizing. I think it's quite good at summarizing. But then even that use, that's a use that sort of plays into a very capitalist notion of us as like productive unit. You know, it's not, you know, I don't like, if I'm thinking like, oh, I'd love to read that novel, but I don't really have the time. I don't want a summary of the novel. I want the time to read the novel. You know?
Yeah. Well, this is interesting. This actually adds a few layers into it, right? Because when we're doing our Expanse podcast, I watched the episode twice. The first time I watched it, enjoyed it, soaked it up as your sort of intended, as it were. And then the second time I watched it on 1.5 speed with subtitles on, checking to see if I follow through, to see what I understand, see what I don't. And I would never watch something I enjoy, particularly for a first time. If I want to enjoy something, I'll play it at the speed that it's intended. So, like, even if it's a TV show or something like that, there have on occasionally podcasts I will put on 1.5, very rarely two, because in a conversational tone like this, people speak a lot slower than they would do on scripted television. So it after 1.5, and I'd be interested to know if anyone else does this, and if you find, you know, listening at home, find these podcasts too long, try 1.5. because I after a while with the 1.5, it sounds normal. Your ears sort of adjust to it. Two times speed, I think, is a bit fast, at least for me, for it to not always be like noticeable. But if I need to watch something that I don't particularly enjoy or whatever, and I can follow it at 1.5. In fact, one thing I have noticed, thanks to my stupid short attention span, is that watching things at 1.5 often keeps me hooked in a bit more effectively.
Oh, yeah, no, I can see that being the case, yeah. I, on the contrary, I never put things on anything but one speed. And it comes from something we've talked about before. To me, it's why I don't mod games. It's the same reason. I know this is bullshit. I know this doesn't make any actual sense, but I want the authored experience. And watching
that does make sense. No, yeah, yeah. Like,
it's not rational. Like, it's not. But I've got a friend, Danny, and we listen to audiobooks together sometimes. And she's like, if she had to listen to things on one speed, she would just get bored and wander off. So she always listens to things on, like, about 1.5, sometimes 2 speed. She's trying to get through as many books as possible as quickly as possible, you know, and also not get bored while listening to them. So when we're listening together, it's on 1.5 speed, and I'm fine with it. Like, say, there's a little period of adjustment, but then it sounds normal. And some of the books, honestly, they're read so slowly that 2 speed actually sounds
aren't they?
So I don't have anything like sort of like morally against it, but for myself, I'm like, it's disrespectful to the author. Even when I'm just listening to some some ad hoc fucking off the cuff podcast, I'm still I've got to respect the artist's integrity.
I don't know, but like, this is, I mean, are we going to fall back into like low art and high art now? Like, because I think this might actually be where the difference is, because like with podcasting's like, it's non-fiction, right? Like, to me, I guess non-fiction.
See, this is where I'm going to argue against myself what I was saying last time, because there isn't really a distinction between high art and low art. Like, not in really a postmodern way, but I think I mentioned something to you. Did I mention this, or did I intend to mention this? There was stop me if I've talked about this when we've been recording before, but I like Star Trek, right? I think I did bring it up last time. I like Star Trek. And in Star Trek, the character, because they're post-capitalist, they don't need to work for survival. They get all their basic needs met. And, you know, they basically live a luxury life for free, what we consider a luxury life for free. So their time is spent, you know, in, you know, creative endeavors and learning and stuff like that. You know, they put on plays and they paint paintings. And there was a post on Fedi saying, like, it always used to, and I shared this, it always used to bother them that, like, they would do paintings, but they're always very mediocre paintings. Like they were kind of like, you know, Sunday afternoon watercolorist paintings. They were kind of very amateurish. And I'd always sort of sneered at that, like, if you've got, you know, all the free time in the world, like, do something a bit more challenging. Like, you should be pushing the boundaries of art, not just like doing like nice landscapes or whatever, and putting on Shakespeare plays in a very, you know, standard way. But so yeah, there was this post saying, no, the whole point is that like when capitalism doesn't exist, that striving doesn't exist, that competitive like spirit doesn't exist. The point is they are doing these things amateurly just for their own enjoyment. Doesn't matter whether it's good or not. You know, you can be a shit painter. If you enjoy it, that's the fucking point. And there's something beautiful in that. And that, you know, that we've talked about before, that's the kind of YouTube channel I like, is just somebody doing it because they love it. And I enjoy the amateurishness because it there's an honesty and an integrity to it. I know I'm not being, you know,
I think manipulated. It feels a little bit like it follows the path of some artists where they start off with very intricate, detailed, technically good stuff, and then they start going into like cubism and postmodernism.
Well, it's the famous I'm gonna mangle this. The famous Picasso quote, where it's something like at the age of 14, I could paint like an old master. It took me the whole of my life to learn how to paint like a child.
Yeah.
There's something to that. Yeah.
I fail to see in a lot of cases how, like, because society fetishizes competition, and I often fail to see how this actually is the best way of building up society in general. Right. Like, it seems that everything is competitive. Like, you know, you got not only sports, but sports hold, you know, take up such a big part of our culture, so much money, but also everything from like politics to business, everything's a conflict, everything's a battlefield, everything's a competition. And I kind of feel like there's got to be like another way, like the best to achieve the best things that we can as a society, as human beings. Surely it's not in spite of each other, but surely to be lifted up by each other, right? Like
It can't be a zero sum game. Like, it's got to be a case of, you know, like cooperative. You know, we both benefit, kind of. So, and I mean, in human history, that does, you know, for the big things. I mean, it's trite to say, but, you know, imagine if licensing existed when, you know, language was invented, and, you know, like only one culture could have language and nobody else had access to that. But,
You know how countries all struggle to pay for the Olympics, or the, you know, like how it becomes such an expensive endeavor, and how the Olympic Committee are finding it more and more difficult to find countries willing to put up the Olympic. Like, it could be the case that everyone in the world comes together and builds a standing Olympic village in Greece, and we could have that as like a central, you know, like monument to us to a coming together. If you know what I mean.
Yeah, sometimes when the Olympics is on, and, you know, there's all this fuss about, you know, this country doesn't want it because they can't afford it, and this, you know, I've looked into whether it is actually economically, whether it's a net cost or a net earner, and nobody seems to be quite sure. Like, there's contradictory. It doesn't. Yeah, nobody's quite sure, because if it is an earner, it's going to be a lot of knock on things, right? It's not going to be like, you know, you make that much money as the Olympics is on. It. Yeah. Look at it that way is kind of sad, right? I don't remember. I don't look at it like that in the past. So, you know, we've become very sort of penny pinching and this whole mentality of being a productive, everybody's got to be productive. Everything's got to have an economic benefit. Yeah, that's it in a nutshell. Everything's got to have an economic benefit, or what's the point?
Yeah. And, actually, bringing this back down to Mastodon, I heard a lot of people saying that when, like, with Mastodon, like, if you can't become an influencer on it, if you can't be famous, then what's the point? And I think to be honest, I think the Fediverse actually does kind of sort of represent that part of us, you know, that part of that's what part of people of, like, the enjoyment of doing something in the face of this of these expectations and of
I think Feddy. Just straight up comparing Feddy to Twitter or something. Like, I think the lack of an algorithm, like, you very quickly on Feddy realize, I don't want to follow too many people, and I don't want too many people following me. There's a reasonable number. There's something you've talked about before. there's a reasonable number of people I can talk to at the same time, you know, and actually have a conversation as opposed to,
Yeah, because I follow a lot of people, like 4,000 or 5,000, but I have a list of VIPs, of which you are one. And there is a list of people who I want to make sure that if they post a status, I catch it. That they're sort of, for, you know, usually like friends, as it were, or people I find particularly interesting.
You have an actual relationship with,
But I mean, it's a hangover from back in the days when Mastodon, or when the Fediverse was tiny, and like you just almost, you'd almost follow anyone that was posting.
You know, like they follow, you follow back.
And but now I don't know. I kind of feel like the Fedi in many ways. Like there's a part of me that thinks that corporations and big organizations and stuff not really taking an interest in the Fedi. I kind of feel a bit relieved, actually, all things considered. Like the UN, not the UN, the EU, they decided to stop their Mastodon project. I'm pretty sure there have been quite a few other similar projects over time. The BBC, they decided to roll back their Fediverse project.
I think it just doesn't, I think, same with Mozilla probably, I think they just can't fit it into their corporate logic because it doesn't have a place there. Because it's explicitly designed not to.
Yeah. And do you know
which I think means that they're kind of behind the times, I think.
I'm not sure. I have a lot of like almost conflicting opinions on this because it's like if Fediverse is like the community center of the internet, you know, like the village hall of the internet, as it were, where it's, you know, like it's just a bunch of bumbling techies just doing their thing. And I mean, I don't want to cast the whole Fediverse as all of that. Like it's all a bunch of, you know, it's alternative. Is like, you know, it's an alternative place, but like it, you know, maybe places like, well, I was gonna say Threads or Blue Sky or whatever might be a better place for the BBC because of the corporate matchup.
Come up a lot. I'd rather corporations not be on Fedi. I don't want the news service on Fedi. I don't want celebrities on Fedi. I want it to be a place that is free from all of the things that are really conditioned by capitalism. You know, in a very straightforward and extreme way, like the notion of a celebrity. Do you know who's that fast? What's her name? Taylor Swift endorsing Kamala, right? And that was somehow news for like 5 fucking days. I know this is almost like a teenager thing to say, but we shouldn't care what a celebrity thinks about politics.
No,
like, or at least we shouldn't care what a celebrity thinks about politics any more than we should care what anybody thinks about politics.
I think this is a bit of a media thing. I don't think celebrity endorsements actually move the needle that much. I think it's more. I mean, I don't know even know if Taylor Swift cares or whatever. But like, I think the media like having Taylor Swift in headlines, and I think that's why it's made the.
I don't see why we should care what this billionaire. Like, she seems like a decent person, and, you know, her music is not my kind of music, but, you know, she seems to care about her music and care about what she does, and, you know, she has integrity, I think. Seems to be a decent person, but I still don't care what she thinks about politics. And, you know, there's the stuff about, you know, she flies all over the place in a private jet and pollutes the shit out of everything, and, you know, like, I don't get why we should care. We explicitly shouldn't care what millionaires and billionaires think about politics because their interests are not aligned with our interests.
No, well, certainly not billionaires. Like, I was trying to guess, right, in California, all the tech bros, which way do they vote? Because for the longest time, I thought they lent Democrat. And I don't know if it's changed or things are coming out of the woodwork or whatever, but it definitely seems like the big money people in Silicon Valley and that kind of place, they're not backing Kamala as much as you'd think, or as much as I used to.
Yeah, I think it's become more acceptable to become, well, I mean, it's, you know, things are more polarized, which is becoming, you know, a cliche at this point, but you know, it's true. I think it's more acceptable. I think tech bros, if you take, you know, take the whole of tech bros as a soup, they're probably still lean more Democrat, I think. But, you know, there's nothing between the Democrats and the Republicans anyway. And, you know, they certainly, you know, the ones with actual money, they certainly donate to both parties, which matters more really than which one they personally want to. This is getting a bit too
Yeah, no, yeah. I mean, it's a money issue. It's a money in politics. You know, like the thing is, we have this problem to a lesser degree in the UK, but like, yeah, like politics and money should be like worlds apart as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
And I think most people probably agree with that, really, you know.
But getting back to the art stuff, so before I was saying, like, fine art is a very distinct thing, it's its own thing, it's doing a very specific thing, it's like research science versus, you know, being like a materials engineer or something, you know, they're pushing the boundaries. Now I'm going to contradict that and say that distinction is complete bullshit. It's all art is the same, all creativity is the same, it's just play, it's just playing, and we should take all these, like, sort of capitalist, elitist, bourgeois readings out of it and just, like celebrate like amateur creativity.
Absolutely, yeah, and I think we said it possibly in one of the earlier freebooters about like the idea of comparing like something from Greg's versus a cake from Village Fete, which I mean I personally like the Village Fete cakes. I can't eat them so much anymore because of vegan, you know, like, so you
okay, can, hot butter and eggs.
Yeah, see, that's kind of, so I do kind of have to, like, I don't know, like, to be fair, there are some great vegan bakeries out there. There's Alex Gooch, who is very expensive, but, like, well, around, the thing is, it's a small chain of Welsh bakeries along, I think, like, the south of Wales. So, like, the recommendation is useless to most people watching this. But if you ever get a chance, Alex Gooch, good bakery. But expensive, okay, like really expensive.
About the art thing again. So I watched, I tweeted this, but nobody cares. you know, we've all seen those videos, I'm sure, of like laughing at state flags, US state flags, basically.
Oh, yes, that's
what right. So they're all, you know, they've all got these very sort of, again, amateurish from the 1800s, usually 1700s, 1800s, like a blue background with like a coat of arms, not a coat of arms, but a crest or a medallion or a seal of some sort on, and they look to our trained modern bourgeois design eyes, they look kind of silly and crude and a bit naive. So there's these videos, then TED Talks and stuff, sort of criticizing state flags and saying, oh, these all look stupid and old and rubbish, and we should replace them with something, you know, that basically adheres to, you know, modernist bourgeois design ideals. And those videos are very popular, and I watched a video the other day making the contrary case. It was somebody on YouTube called Pre-Modernist. I like his videos, does good videos, and he was sort of going through the making the case that I just kind of made about, like, we should celebrate that these were made by real people and they had real meaning, you know, they have symbolism in them that has actual meaning to people, and they come from real circumstances. Yeah, and a lot of the flags, most of the ones with a blue background and then some kind of seal on them, they go back to the Civil War. And somebody summed it up in a comment saying, like, you know, I can't remember what the wording was, but it was like loser modern design flag versus, you know, this flag that literally killed slavers. But the point is, they've got a history to them, and actual people in actual circumstances design these things, and like sneering at them because they don't adhere to modernist design thingies is a lot missing the point.
Yeah, so I just popped up the Montana flag there. Now, apart from the word Montana, there's a lot of flags that do kind of have that navy field with a seal, a crest, a badge, or something in the middle. So I know exactly what you mean, and I watched the video.
The Montana, I learned this from the video, though, actually. Montana isn't actually one of those. It's just kind of mimicking them, because Montana didn't actually exist, or at least I think it wasn't, like, it was partly incorporated territory. But, yeah, so that is actually a modern one that's copying the style of the other northern ones.
What's an example of a...
like a Virginia or something.
Virginia, that's the one.
Also, yeah, I do agree that writing the name of the place on the flag is a bit silly.
Well, see, this is where the video, I don't know, this might be one of those videos that might have, like, I don't know if it changed my mind, but it certainly gave me a hell of a lot to think about. It's definitely given me, I'll just put Virginia up as another example. And it kind of got me thinking, the first question I had walking away from that video that you sent me was...
Oh, did you watch it? You watched
it? Yeah, well, I watched it. It was, a really good video. Time. Really enjoyed it. And I do follow, I follow CGP Grey as well, so I knew the references that he was making. Mm. And the first question I had walking away from that video was, what's the purpose of a flag? Because, like, I get all the history and the stuff, and that's kind of important, right? But what's the use case of a flag?
Americans, oh, this is going to get, yeah. So Americans seem to like flags more than we do, right? They attach more importance to them. They attach a lot of importance to their national flag. I know a lot of Americans would be deeply offended if you, you know, did, you know, fire to the American flag. You know, it comes up as a political issue sometimes. Whereas I think most Brits, certainly Brits who feel that way, but most Brits, like, if somebody set fire to the Union Jack, I don't give a shit. I imagine, like, French and Italian people probably even feel more like I mean, America has this, you know, recent revolutionary history and then the Civil War, and that, you know, that's why flags became an important military thing and they became important in their culture. That's the reason for it. It's not just because they're idiots. But then that infects stuff like, you know, like queer movements, you know, having the gay pride flag, and then we've got, you know, a million flags, you know, the bisexual flag, the lesbian flag, we've got all these
but
flags.
Also, the history of the rainbow flag is quite interesting too. It used to have hot pink in it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But these flags, it's the choice to use a flag. Like, as sort of leftists, we don't really very much like nation states. We don't like borders. We don't like boundaries. We don't like dividing people up. And flags are, to me, I see flags as part of that process.
Yeah.
So attaching a flag to something that's supposed to be progressive, using a flag to symbolize it, is always, I'm not saying we shouldn't use it. I'm not shitting on them. But it's a complicated thing.
Yeah. I mean, for me personally, I feel like the sense, I know it's unavoidable, but the sense of national identity always makes me feel a bit odd, because it's like obviously you're going to have an identity based on where you come from. That's basically what your identity is, right? But you know, like the whole idea of like being like proud of where you're from, because you happen to be from there and all that, like
as soon as you define it and contain it, it's exclusive, it's exclusionary.
Yeah and I think by, yeah,
like a queer campaign or something would say, no, well, queer is inclusive. Of course, the concept of queerness is inclusive. Anybody can be queer. But I do think using a flag, as soon as you symbolize things in that particular way, that has that historical context, for me, that does feel exclusive and exclusionary. I'm not saying the queer flag is that, but, you know.
It's, well, the queer flag is interesting because it's, well, first of all, not a nation, but also it's a statement. So, for example, like, some people will say that, like, you know, if you're like an ally or something, you should be flying the pride flag to let, you know, other queer people know they're safe with you, for example. So that flag,
and even the ally language, I think that's part of the same coherent sort of rationalization of how this stuff works. Like, I don't consider myself an ally. Because ally, the way it's used in these kind of, you know, IDPOL context, implies that those are the ones with the interests in fighting, and we are just, you know, well-meaning people who want to help out. But that's not how I see it. We're all fighting the same fight.
Yeah.
We all have the same shared interests. We're not different groups with different interests working together. We have the same shared interests, which the peculiarities and details of which differ. But I'm not an ally. I'm an accomplice. So I understand why people who have been shit on, they want symbols as a way of coming together. I understand that, of course. I'm not shitting on any of this. I'm not saying people shouldn't use the pride flag or you know, looking down on anybody who does. These symbols are important, but the choice of the flag format in particular, I do find a little bit unsettling.
What do you mean by the flag format?
Sorry?
What do you mean by the flag format?
Well, it is like a national, it's a flag. Literally a flag. It's like a national flag, a thing that represents a national state, which is an inherently exclusive and usually combative thing that, you know, conquers other states and has hostile relationships and blah blah blah. I think that's because it was an American thing. I think that's why everything in America has to be represented by a flag. I'm not shitting on the queer movement whatsoever. If it seems that way, I'm not at all. There comes a point where, yeah, you're coming together in safety is good, but then also recognizing, you know, we have a lot in common. We've got shared interests. The point is we're working together in this, not that we're all going into our own little.
But isn't that the beauty of the rainbow flag? Because everyone's under the rainbow. Do you know what I mean?
Like, oh yeah, no, yeah, I'm on board with that. Yeah, yeah.
So it's a rebellious flag in that sense of
the, oh no, it is. Yeah, 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 yeah. And its history, you know, it came from a proud and honourable history and all that. Yeah,
yeah. So anyway, what I was thinking is, like, so the purpose of a flag Now, there are lots of purposes of our flag.
Also, I recognise the irony of having a Soviet flag behind me.
So when one of the uses of a flag, I'm just going to give a random example because there are millions of uses of a flag, is when you're selecting your language for like a website or something, right?
Yeah.
And you have a selection of international symbols for each country.
Yeah.
That is languageless. You know, that is wordless, and that is really good. Not everyone needs to know every flag, but most people are going to need to know the flags of the countries of the language.
How do you feel when to choose English, you have to choose the American flag, or you know, a Mexican person has to choose the Spanish flag, or vice versa, or you know, like because those flags don't represent languages.
Well, no, because Brazilian Spanish and Spanish are different.
Well, Brazilian's Portuguese, but Mexican Spanish.
Sorry, Argentinian Spanish.
They're mutually intelligible. Like they can understand. They are different, of course, got different vocabulary and stuff. But they're mutually intelligible. They are variants of the same language.
Yeah.
But no, how do you feel when you have to choose the American flag?
I think that the website designer is lazy and has only done English for both. That being said, there's not really much of. I don't mind, to be honest. I don't care. It's fine. Yeah, I'll take.
There's not a little flash of irritation.
Well, the fact that it's called English and you're like, it would make sense.
That's like, when I become a nationalist. That's when I'm like, no, it's English. The default English is called English. It's not called UK English. It's not called British English. It's English. And that's when I get all
property. Yeah, but then if they start spelling colour without a U,
then it is American English. Yeah.
So, I don't know. Yeah. I don't think it really matters. But none of that. That's all completely technical.
The point with that is just that a national flag isn't a symbol of a language, it's a symbol of a country. And even using national flags as symbols of countries carries the very mild implication that, like, if you're British and you don't speak English, you're not really British. It's not really, I'm not saying it's explicitly saying it, but
I don't necessarily think so. If the like, I can see, like, okay, so for example, in the case of, well, I don't know, like, this is where like the nuances of language come in, because for Welsh, for example, obviously if you want to select the Welsh language logo, you click on the Welsh flag. However, the vast majority of people in Wales still speak English, so I don't think there's any no one's offended or no one thinks it's necessarily wrong that you select the Welsh flag for the Welsh language. And even in that context, selecting the English flag for the English language is fine too. I guess it's not a cut and dry kind of thing, but as long as people understand it, it's understandable. That I guess is the point I'm trying to come across, is that, like, yeah, it might not necessarily be super.
It has implications.
It has
it implies that languages are mapped to countries one to one, and it also implies that languages, you know, a language belongs to one country only.
Except we click on American flag, so.
Well, that's when it's sort of being self-contradictory, right?
Well, it's only a function, so it's just like, it's.
I mean, one thing, like, we should have symbols for languages, or even better, just use the words.
But then, in which language do you use the words, right?
Well, when you're choosing your language, I mean, it's usually this way in video games, when you're choosing your language, each language is written in that language's language.
Like
Mandarin Chinese will be written in Chinese, and English will be written in English, and then you can always find your own language.
Yeah, that's the only way to do it.
Literally happened today where I mentioned I was playing Moon Hunters with Danny. She just pressed some buttons and accidentally switched it to Chinese, and she was like, how do I switch it back? Yeah, but use words.
What you can do in HTML is, if you have a paragraph in a different language, you can you can tag that paragraph in that language. Mm. So lang equals da da da. I wonder how that works. I'm sure I've used that. Yeah, no, I have used that before because of Welsh translation stuff. It's like you gotta, but I've never seen that used in a use case, as in, like.
I think we don't notice it as English speakers, because we. Like, most of the web is in American English. Our browsers, if we've got a computer set up right, send English GB as the language that we want, But then what the server returns is probably, you know, any variant of English. But like if you're a Spanish speaker or something, you probably encounter this a lot, I would imagine.
Yeah. Well, I'd be interested to hear.
I'm not really sure what that does.
But so you would disagree with the premise of using flags as national identifiers anyway?
Not that. Also, I just want to say, like, if you're going to use a flag for English, shouldn't it be the English flag rather than the British flag?
Yeah. Maybe, yeah.
But
I
then
guess,
the English flag has become this, you know, because of how it's used now. Like the English flag, I find the English flag distasteful now, which is a shame.
That's just...
It's become a right-wing nationalist symbol.
That's the association. Yeah, I know what you mean, but like... It is just
a
symbol, yeah.
And this really pisses me off. I feel like, because the British flag, the Union Jack, not the Union flag, it's the Union Jack. Not a Jack, but it's called the Union Jack. That's his fucking name. It's a very ugly flag. Whereas I think the St. George's Cross is quite an attractive flag. So I wish, can the racists use the uglier one and we can... but then you're not English, you're Welsh. Your flag is great.
It's all right. It sounds a bit silly, but the white at the top is mildly irritating because it doesn't frame itself. Like a nice square.
Oh, I see what you mean, the background or whatever.
Yeah, like the Polish flag or something like that.
I'm sorry, though, I keep interrupting you. I'm sorry. What you were saying, flags being attached to nations, I think.
Okay, yeah. So what about, as a simpler version, so do you disagree with that premise, as flags being used as identifiers for nations?
I mean, that's what they are, but I don't like nations. Like, I feel like, I think this is something that, like, the left has always been, ultimately, and anti-borders, anti-national, pro-pan-national, pro-coming together, and we want to get rid of borders, you know, blah, blah. These are all artificial constructs of politics that we should be at least, you know, aiming towards getting away from. And, you know, the Labour Party recently certainly absolutely turned their backs on that, right?
Yeah.
And also,
I just want to reiterate for the audience that when we say that we want, like, when we distaste, like, or when we're not necessarily too fond of nations, borders, etc., we're not saying get rid of all the borders now, let everyone, do you know what I mean? Like,
No. We have to bring everybody up to the same level, and then
it's a process. But,
and I'm not against, like, I think it's sad that flags have become attached to, you know, these political bound regions that contain and exclude. Like, if we got rid of borders and people wanted to have the English flag to show that like, this is the land that I'm from. I like this land. You know, I like the terrain. I like the landscape. I like the people. I like the food. You know, like whatever. There's nothing wrong with liking where you are from and being in that sense proud of where you're from. But that, to me, that would extend to, you know, a Bangladeshi who arrived as an immigrant today. They're just as English as I am, and they have just as much, you know, ownership over that as I do. And somebody who doesn't even live here, you know, somebody just likes, you know, like I like Byzantium. I've got an interest. Like, I feel some kind of connection to Byzantium. So if I wanted to show that, you know, that's how flags should be, I think. Not an exclusive, exclusionary, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we do that sometimes, right? Don't we? I mean, I know we're thinking of the worst of it now with the far right stuff. But when I go down, like, you know, like by the allotments near where I live, like all the old men have all kinds of flags up. It's
like, what kind of flags? Yeah.
Well, my dad had the Venetian flag up, but I've seen.
Why the Venetian flag?
He likes Venice. No other reason.
I like Byzantium. So I hate Venice. Venice fucked Byzantium over. Oh, yeah, they were the ones who caused the fall of Byzantium. So me and your dad were enemies now. dig up his allotment and salt the.
Does Byzantine have a flag?
I think there are. I mean, there were pre that, you know, like ancient countries didn't have flags as such, but there were banners and emblems that were associated with them. So, yeah,
well, that's where the Welsh flag came from. Henry VII, the Welsh bastard or something they called him.
Yeah. What's their broad family? What's their broad Or Tudor? What was the name for the? They ruled the sort of west northwest part of, like, that. There was that sort of
the Rose
region. Don't worry about it. I can't remember what I'm trying to.
All right. But yeah. So anyway, yeah. So I guess what? So you if it, Now, there's a distinction between state flags and nation flags here as well, right? Because, like, ships come into this a little bit, I think, right? But with those seal on a blue background, you couldn't select out of a menu of those, right? Like, it couldn't be a drop-down menu.
Why not?
Because they would all look too similar.
That's his point in the video, right? They are all recognizable at a glance if you're as used to, you know, because, like, you know, Germany, Belgium, what's the other? There's a few that are like black, yellow, red, right? In different.
Netherlands,
France. There are a bunch of flags that have the same colors in different. Oh, and all, of course, like you mentioned in the video, all the Scandinavian flags having the.
Oh, yeah. UK, France, Belgium. Yeah, all it's the red, white, and blue tricolors, yeah.
Netherlands. So unless you have learned, like, which is which in those cases, that's the only way you know at a glance which is which. And he's saying it's the same with the state flags. You know that this one has two human supports, therefore it is Virginia, and this one has, you know, two deer or whatever, so it's whatever that one is. And I think that's just because we're not familiar with them. I think that's what that is.
Possibly, but, like, if you scale them down, I mean, I'm talking about a hypothetical case where, you know, you've got, like, a language menu of flags. Yeah. You scale them down to a postage stamp size and...
Yeah. I still think there's enough distinctions.
Like, with Montana or something. No, I don't even know if Montana... Like, you can do it with the United States flag.
Pins, right? You talked about pins, mm-hmm. which is, in terms of resolution, probably about the same as the smallest you're going to use it in the context we're talking about. And I think they're still, if you're used to looking at them, it's like, you know, the seal on this one is this shape, this one's got these supports, this one's got a scroll underneath it. You know, I think you would know what those differentiators are even at that size, I think. I get your point, of course, yeah. Something that is solid in three colours or whatever is more...
And I'm only saying that on a functional point of view, right? Like, I'm not... throwing in any personal opinions on that.
Well, again, as he says in the video, should that one particular niche use be the thing that defines the design parameters of the thing when that's not its main use, you know?
Well, this is the key question of flags.
Which comes back to the logo as well, actually.
Yeah, but with flags, right, like, it's like, but what are they? Like, are flags now just like a collective national piece of art? I was thinking when he was doing the video, right? He was showing the flag of, I think it was Milwaukee.
I love them, and
it's like, I used to think Milwaukee flag was a silly flag, but actually, like, I don't know, I'm kind of getting on board with it. Let me just.
I love it. It's like somebody just threw some clip art together.
It's
fucking charming. Oh, you've put it in already.
Yeah. And actually, on that note, when the letters are integrated with the graphics, I don't mind it as much at all. Mm. It's when you got it stamped in fucking Helvetica. That's what.
Yeah.
That's what that is. It's literally Helvetica. Like,
yeah.
At least, yeah, Milwaukee, like, is a bit more a part of the overall design.
It would be so nice if every state, like, had, you know, or every whatever that has a flag, like, they're all... a bit more individual, a bit more like, we made this, we're proud of it, this is what we like. It might not be what you like, but this is what we like, so we're happy. Yeah. Not all world has to have the same bourgeois, modernist ideas of what looks good and what looks bad. Horrible.
I don't know if it was that video or whether or not it was just like before then, but yeah, like, I think I've definitely come around to the Milwaukee flag, and it looks to me, although I don't know if that Native American gentleman in the top left is appropriate nowadays. But I mean, you know, you can tweak things.
I mean, they're all on some level problem. Even the ones that, you know, that he was expressing pride of because they fought on the right side in the Civil War, and he was specifically, you know, they were an anti, you know, he's seeing them as an anti-slavery thing, but they're still military flags. Is militarism something they want to celebrate as part of our identity? You know, that's questionable for me.
It is, but, like, I think flags have gone, or at least, yeah, I think particularly with state flags, I think they've gone beyond militarism. Maybe it's probably close to military history than it is to
But then would you make the same, this is complete devil's advocate, but like, would you make the same case for the Confederate flag? Well, like, we're enough removed from that now that the Confederate flag is just a symbol of Southern pride, you know, pride in their culture and heritage and blah, not pride in, you know, having fought to maintain slavery.
I think it could have been that way.
Yeah.
I don't think it is that way because.
Yeah. When I was a kid, the TV show Dukes of Hazzard, right?
Mm.
So in Dukes of Hazzard, they have an orange Dodge Charger, I think it is, and it has the Confederate flag painted on the roof.
Yeah.
And every kid my age at that time had little, you know, toy cars of the General Lee, which is, he was a Confederate general, that's the name of the car. And it's got the Confederate flag on the top. We just played with them, you know. We didn't know that this was or would become, was and would become a racist symbol. You know?
Yeah,
it would be nice if it could have become detached from that.
Yeah, I would say it became a racist symbol because of how it was used and the messaging behind it and the context. And
yeah, I think you'll be careful with that because obviously when it, you know, when it was what it was historically, it was a racist symbol at that time because it was a symbol of the factions that wanted to preserve slavery, but then it could have been rehabilitated, perhaps.
Yeah, exactly. Like, because there are lots of things that are rehabilitated, like pirates. And
I think pirates we sort of see as like the less bad guys.
Yeah, but like,
you know, you got these, you know, the British, Spanish, Dutch navies going out doing colonialism, and then the pirates doing something else at least, you know, something. and by all accounts, it was a much more pleasant experience to be on a pirate ship than on, you know, British Navy ship in particular.
I'd imagine so. Yeah. But also suit jackets, they are of a military design, but we don't even think of them as military. So I don't even know. The thing is, I think military history and national history are kind of.
I think there's a distinction between a purely military history and something that was used for, you know, like. I don't think either of us would argue that we should have rehabilitated the Nazi flag for Germany, you know, kept that as the flag, you know, because it represented a very particular... These things are fraught, I think. And it's like the argument of, you know, do we leave these statues of slavers up and put a plaque on saying this dude was a slaver, you know, when the statue was erected, we were proud of this, and now we think this is fucking disgusting, you know, and leave it there as a monument of... I mean, another thing that comes into it is that those statues aren't old. They were erected as racist in the 19th century. But pretending that wasn't the case, like, should you keep them as a monument of, you know, the German, like, never forget? You know, like, do we erase that history or do we preserve it? And, you know,
I mean, statues are a very specific thing because they are fundamentally a tool of celebration. Or, you know, you're putting it up, they're on pedestals, you know, they're literally on pedestals.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, so it's, I don't think it's not, I don't see statues as being educational, really.
No, I don't, especially because of the time and place, time and sentiment under which they were erected. I'm 100% tear the racist statues down, but I see, I do to a point see the argument. Not in a museum, if it matters,
you know.
I think the argument in the case of those statues is fraudulent, but in a broader sense, what'd you say?
I mean, if the statues are that important, which most of them are just like what Victorian, stick them in a museum or something. They don't have to be there. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like put something that you're proud of there. Put something nice. You know, it's
I agree. Yeah,
you wouldn't have it. I say you wouldn't have it in your home. You wouldn't have something that evokes the same sentiment at home, really, would you?
But then there is definitely the sort of statute of limitations on it. You know, there's a time and a historical distance and a sort of sense that we've progressed enough. Because part of the problem with America is it's still extremely fucking racist, and that's why this stuff all hurts. Whereas for us, I mean, you know, 1,000 years ago, we were colonized by the Romans. And it was a brutal occupation, but you know we still have, you know, but we celebrate the remains of the Roman Empire, right? We you know, in Bath and wherever, and this village actually had a Roman fort. And we celebrate them and we're proud of them, but you know they were a brutal occupation.
Yeah.
But there definitely comes a point at which you are removed enough from it to be able to just say this is part of our fabric.
Yeah, like you can. You know, you have light-hearted comedy shows about life in ancient Rome and stuff, don't you? Like,
You're up Pompeii.
Yeah. So you got, yeah, like, so I don't know. Yeah, so anyway, we've, this flag video, anyway, right. Should we, I'll put the link to the, what's the link? Do you want to put the link
to
the flag
video? It's a really great video. Sorry, do you want me to find the link? Yeah.
Yeah. And I did watch it on 1.5 speed because it's a long video.
It's a long video. I like
it. And he does talk quite slowly in it, but yeah. Very well. Yeah. And also he spoke very clearly, which also makes a difference. If someone doesn't speak clearly, then you got to slow it down a bit.
You also had a bit of, like, if he was contradicting himself or something, there was a bit of wit there, a bit of like,
yeah,
self, what's the word? Self aware.
It was a very good presentation style. And I like that the comments on the video were quite funny as well. It's like, oh, the beef. This is the YouTube genre I came for.
I think the top comments on something like this is effectively like a 2-hour long, strongly worded letter.
Yeah. So if a flag is a bit of this is the thing. I see a huge distinction between national flags and state flags. I think they actually. They seem to have very, very, very different purposes, right? So you would fly a flag on a ship so the people would know from what nation that ship comes from.
Yeah.
Which, is that some kind of legal thing or a expectation?
Yeah.
Or a, so
it's a legal thing because certain ships are allowed to go to certain places and that kind of thing, right? Different countries have different agreements as to, you know.
That kind of thing.
I can know what I'm talking about, something like that.
Yeah, so to me, there seems to be like a much more practical use for them in that particular use instance, almost to the point where you'd think that the maritime sector would have their own system, you know, their own modern.
Yeah, but it's still referring to, you know, a national flag represents a country, and a country is a political idea that says these people are part of this and everybody else isn't, and we get to decide who can come in. And that's the bit I don't like. And if we got rid of nations, we wouldn't need national flags for ships, obviously. It wouldn't matter where they came from. But then, yeah, like you say, like state flags in America, or like county flags over here, or like for me, like the flag of Mercia, which is a kingdom that hasn't existed for, what, 700 years, that I still feel some attachment to. And I'm like, fuck you, Wessex, you fucked us over. You know, I feel attachment to the Mercia flag for some reason. But yeah, over here, I think like county flags, they're used, we see them used in, you know, when the council is doing something. You know, it's like they're nicer, they're a more inclusive, community-ish. Yeah. Because they're not part of that exclusive political, you know.
Oh, I think I found quite an interesting flag. I think I found the cross of Neath, the battle flag of Llywelyn ap Gruffydd, and I'm sure I've butchered his name. So is I think I'm looking up the Welsh local flags. This is my favourite Welsh local flag. I'll just put this right because I don't know. Like, this is Merionethshire. And it's just like, so that's an example of our county flag. And I like our county flags. They're kind of fun.
Here's mine. This is Staffordshire county flag.
Ah, that's quite nice.
That's the Staffordshire knot, not a
pretzel. Oh, the Staffordshire knot. Isn't that just a knot, or is it upside down?
It's called the Staffordshire knot. And there's like a lot of mythology about what it came from, what it's about. And one of them is it was a knot that was designed so that you could hang three people at once. Which definitely isn't true.
Were they that hard up on rope back then?
Apparently, yeah. Wow.
So it seems like in the UK, county flags are just a bit of fun, really, aren't they? Just a bit of...
We're certainly less. I mean, I think we're less serious about a national flag. We don't really care about... Like, there's definitely people who do, but, you know, and our county flags are just, it's just something nice to say. Oh, the council's doing something good.
Yeah,
cool.
Yeah.
Council's having a little book celebration of children's fiction or something cool.
So I guess you didn't put the video, did you put the video in the link in the end, the link
I did,
video in
all those flags. I should probably say like the who it is and the name of the video, that probably people find it better. So it's on Premodernist on YouTube, spelled how you'd expect, and it's in defense of state flags.
Which, but it is definitely a video worth watching, because it definitely gave me so much to think about. I didn't agree with everything in it, but it certainly, like, I don't know, made me think about a few things that I'd previously sort of...
I think the really sort of valuable part is because all these snobbish videos about these flags are terrible. They all refer to this one book, right? Which I can't remember what it's called, but it's like How to Design a Good Flag or something. Mm-hmm. Which is just really, and he nailed it. Like they really, and this is a modernist thing. They treat simplicity as a virtue without really ever justifying that.
Yeah.
And that's what it all boils down to, I think. And also the thing, what he was saying, like, because it says there should be no text on a flag. He uses the Iranian flag as an example, a counterexample of that. Because the Iranian flag, it's three colors, and then the sort of the design in the middle, which is stylized calligraphic rendering of Allah, and then the border between the two, between where the colors meet, is Allah or Akbar over and over again. So, you know, it's got a lot of, text is a big part of that flag, and it's a beautiful flag.
That is a beautiful flag. It's one of my favorites. Mm. And the amazing thing about this flag, that it does, is that it uses red and green without it looking Christmassy.
Yeah. Yep.
I like the Allahu Akbar. The design in the center. I don't know if this is a simple flag or not. So, you know, obviously simplicity is like hugely subjective, but like if you took away the writing, I would say that's a relatively minimalist flag.
Yes, I think it's the design in the middle that makes it, you know, by their standards, not minimalist. Not to the extent of, because he uses the Portuguese flag as an example. He says it's one of his favorite flags. I'm ambivalent about the Portuguese flag, but it's an attractive flag. I think modernist, and this is a received thing for a lot of people. But for somebody writing a book about something to do with aesthetics, they should really justify why minimalism/simplicity is a virtue in and of itself, because it isn't actually. It's just a product of a particular way of thinking about design that certainly, you know, the Victorians would not find what we find attractive. They wouldn't find it. They'd find it horrific. Mm. Like it's bare. You know, it's.
What was that flag with the carpet design on?
Oh, is that? It was one of the stands, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Was it Tajikistan?
Not Tajikistan. Kazakhstan. No. Oh, I'll tell you what, though. Kazakhstan's flag is cool.
Really?
Oh, hell yeah. Shit, how did we not know Kazakhstan had such a cool
flag? Turkmenistan.
That's it, Turkmenistan.
Oh, look at that. That's great.
How did we not know?
That looks like it's very Game of Thrones. It's very like, oh, there's an army coming over there. You know.
Yeah, it is Game of Thrones, isn't it? Yeah. Because you've got that like banner type thing in the middle.
Your banner.
Shit, that I had no idea. Is that a new flag?
Kazakhstan.
Adopted 32 years ago.
Okay, so fairly modern.
Well, not.
What was the previous flag? Far less attractive.
Yeah,
it's like a worse Iranian flag.
Yeah,
so put it in.
I don't know. I don't recognize that flag. The new Iranian flag.
Mm.
That one was just like, but it's lovely. Like it's amazing. So no, you were saying. Sorry, was it Turkmen? I mean, the same thing kind of applies to Kazakhstan. That carpet design down the left-hand side, right? I'll try and find a good depiction of it. Because this is an interesting one, because I kind of didn't know what to make of this flag, right? And he makes a really good case for it. So this flag is obviously, like, even though it's intricate, it's recognizable. And it has, he says, is it the five patterns down the side represent the five different tribes that came together for the nation or something like that?
Major tribes or ethnic groups, yeah.
And the moon and stars, yeah. is that an Islam thing?
And it is a little bit offensive to modernist sensibilities, right? It's a bit like, you know, that's not what a flag should look like. But I agree with him that I'd rather have uniqueness and individuality. This is where individuality is good, rather than just homogeneity of, you know.
I will, however, and I hope this is not problematic, it is slightly Christmassy.
I was literally going to say that. This is probably going to be incredibly offensive to members of these ethnic groups, but that could be a Christmas cracker. That could be the pattern on a Christmas cracker. I'm sorry to those tribes.
Shameful. But it's, I mean, well, I like it as a design, though. It's a lovely design.
I mean, do you know what? That's probably, that is where Christmas cracker designs come from, actually. It comes from carpet, or at least fabric weaving things from Scandinavia, I think. Like those kind of patterns, they have a Scandinavian weaving origin.
I like these weaving patterns. And when he was talking about the Turkmenistan nomadic culture, about how, like, so Turkmenistan tribes back in the day, they would express their art through carpets because they were nomadic. Mm-hmm. So they weren't going to be hanging up paintings everywhere they go, mm-hmm. but they mm-hmm. do make everyday use of carpets. So their artistic expression was done through carpets. And I think that's just so cool that
I thought the South Carolina example, you a good example of the I don't like CGP Grey. He is in that category for me of YouTubers / thinkers / writers who just represent bourgeois good taste back to us. And they're very middle of the road, very dull. And because it's that, because it's kind of unthinking, he criticized the South Carolina flag, and, you know, well, he was saying, like, you know, things should have a historical resonance, and then not researching what the historical resonance was of the things he was criticizing, which is a stupid old. But yeah, I don't like that. I don't like those sneering, snobbish, middle brow. It's middle brow. I hate middle brow. I like middle low brow. I like high brow. Middle brow.
Middle brow. You know. Is that actually an expression?
Yeah, oh yeah. Not you know, it's one in response to highbrow and lowbrow. Yeah. Because I think both highbrow stuff and lowbrow stuff are enjoyable. You want to say?
Six-tenths brow?
Sorry? Six-tenths brow. No, I say like the epitome of, well, not the epitome, but a good popular example, like Marvel films.
Mm.
You know, they are distinct. They're not highbrow. They're not lowbrow. They are middlebrow. And because of that, they're very just, they don't do And they don't know what lowbrow does well. They don't know what highbrow does well. They just end up doing nothing at all.
Hmm.
It's just aesthetic slop.
Okay.
It's like AI output.
What would you say is lowbrow? Just would you say like cockfighting? Or
I mean, cockfighting is certainly lowbrow, but I wouldn't find it. I don't think of an example of something lowbrow that I'm into. I mean, okay. Go on.
Well, this
this is amateurish highbrow.
Amateurish highbrow.
I would say me the movie 2012 or Roland Emmerich movies in general. Like,
I've not seen that.
They're not trying to be clever. They're very fucking dumb. Or The Fast and the Furious. That's lowbrow, and it's exciting and it's honest about what it's doing. It's not pretending to be anything more elevated than it is. It is honestly doing what it's doing, and it's doing what it does well.
I'll take your word for it. I've only seen Tokyo Drift when it came out, and
I've only actually seen the first Fast and Furious, but I enjoy it.
I mean, how many? There's like seven of them now.
A lot.
They can't stop. Yeah. Well, once you've bought the cars, I guess you want to get a few goes out of them or something, right?
But yeah, they're lowbrow. But they're enjoying it. There's an honesty to lowbrow. There's an honesty, but coming off to highbrow. But middlebrow is always pretending it's more elevated than it is, while being just as dumb as the lowbrow stuff. So it's in this very middle-class feeling, very bourgeois feeling, very middle of the road, very unchallenging.
Does it feel like gentrification?
Yeah. I think it's just in the same part. It's unchallenging while making you think that you're a bit elevated for watching it. Game of Thrones as well is middlebrow, I would say.
I don't know. I think it contains elements of all sorts.
I think fantasy might be I like fantasy, but I think fantasy might just be inherently middlebrow.
Well, see, the thing in Game of Thrones, right, there are parts of it that are lowbrow, right? Like, you know, a lot of the gratuitous violence, it was obviously there for shock value, for that, and a lot of the sexual violence was there, you know, just to like, for shock value and stuff like that. And that I would put under the lower brow stuff. But then you've got the higher brow stuff, which is like the more like philosophical stuff,
but it doesn't really do any of it intimates and it has the form of that, but without ever actually what would you say that Game of Thrones is at any point saying about politics, other than, you know, the usual sort of liberal boomer take of like authoritarianism is bad but sometimes it's okay?
So well it's So it's like, you know, you've got the White Walkers that are representing like the, you know, like a threat of climate change. You've got a lot, like you've got like his, you've got like a little sort of historical buffet of kind of stuff, haven't you? Like
that's what I mean, like, by the form. It's got things that could be read as representing particular things, but it doesn't say anything about any.
See, I'm tempted to I'm going to like exercise restraint on this because like the showrunners and George R. R. Martin kind of for a lot of the show I don't think were working particularly well together. So
yeah,
I could maybe take some of the points on the books when it's like George's vision, but Dan and Dave are fucking clueless when it comes to that kind of stuff. Which, and I think they botched a lot of it.
Well, let me counterpose it with shows that I think are highbrow.
Mm-hmm.
And then the two very obvious ones, Sopranos and Deadwood, two shows I've watched recently after meaning to for 20 years. So Sopranos is about these awful, horrible fucking people, which is certainly the case in Game of Thrones too. There's some awful people in it, but they're awful people, but you feel affection towards these people and you're rooting for them at certain times. And the point, I mean, the show is also about societal collapse and the collapse of culture and what it feels like to be at the end of something like a civilization or whatever. But it also, it's these horrible people that it makes you feel affection for these horrible people. And then you're like, what does it say about me that it makes me feel affection for these fucking sociopaths who are doing horrific things? And then Deadwood, Western show on the surface, but it's really about, it's the opposite of that. It's about what does it mean to create a society? What does it mean to imbue things with symbolic meaning that we can all come together and agree on that gives us society and civilization? And how does that affect the people that are building it? What does it do to them? How does it change them? And, you know, it's about those things. And I think that's what makes it happen. I don't think Game of Thrones ever, in tiny way, sure, but like really was really trying to do anything like that.
I would say under a more faithful adaptation, it would do. Because
Read the book. I don't think the books do it either.
Do you not?
No, I think they represent things. You go, oh, that's a bit like, you know, such and such war, or you know, that, yeah, that's climate change, or this is about how the classes relate to each other. But it's not saying, it's just going, look, that looks a bit like this, doesn't it? And that looks a bit like this, but it's not saying anything about any of that. In the same way that Marvel films aren't saying anything about, you know, war is bad. You know, you're like, they're not really saying anything.
They're not saying, I suppose so. You know,
I'm not saying all middle-brow things are shit. I do think they all have that homogenizing kind of bourgeois kind of thing going on. But I enjoy some middle.
What's something that's middle-brow that's a bit more indie, like a little less, you know, well-known or mainstream?
Less mainstream, but middle-brow.
Like, because we're talking Marvel films, we're talking Game of Thrones. That's all stuff, is middle-brow almost like mainstream? Is middle-brow basically being used as a term for mainstream? That type of mainstream?
Yeah, but I think it's a fairly recent phenomenon, the extent to which the middle brow has taken over the mainstream. Yeah, I think, and I think this is to do with a sort of political development. You know, as working class people, because of Thatcher and stuff, working class people started to see themselves as more middle class people and made that transition. And I think it's the media. It's very much like people being beer connoisseurs. They don't have the sort of the cultural comfort or whatever to allow them to be wine connoisseurs, because that's not the drink of their class that they came from. They came from a working class history, so they take beer, pretend that it's something you can be a connoisseur about, and then feel highbrow while indulging with something lowbrow, which makes it, you know, because of maths middle brow. And I think this middle brow really expanded when working class people started to sort of think of themselves as being middle class, you know.
Hang
as
on a
Thatcher
minute.
And
why can you not be a connoisseur about beer, but you can be a connoisseur about wine?
That's going to be contentious, right? I think you can be a connoisseur about anything, but it didn't have a history.
Lemonade.
Wine has had a history of that because it was a highbrow thing. It was a thing that the posh people drank, and posh people had enough time to sit around and compare this wine to that wine, whereas beer was something you drank to get pissed. Or, well, you know, but earlier than that, was just the safe thing to drink because water wasn't particularly safe. It never had the history of that. So that highbrow or upper class form is imposed on this working class practice that doesn't have that history or culture.
Yeah. So
essentially, it's people who used to be working class, becoming middle class, and then being ashamed of the working. They can't engage with lowbrow culture anymore because they feel a bit more elevated than that, you know, and that people will see that, oh God, they're actually working class.
Is
so we sneer at the lowbrow and pretend we're highbrow while engaging with middlebrow.
So what would lowbrow be on telly? Would that be like EastEnders?
I think soaps are all inherently lowbrow, but that's different. Like Carry On films,
okay,
which are great, and I would love to see. It's one of the, you know how Americans, they love Doctor Who, they love these things because they're British and they have this Britishness to them, right? They love Doctor Who, they love Harry Potter, they love even Game of Thrones, even though it's written by, you know, it's still a Britishness that they're engaging with. I want the world to discover Carry On now. Because I think they're wonderful. They're a real expression of Britishness at that time. You know, they're made in the, you know, 50s, 70s, so they've got some problematic aspects, but they're distinctly British.
It has been so long since I've seen a Carry On film. They used to be on like ITV on Sundays and stuff.
Oh yeah. They're filler TV, weren't they?
Oh my God! You were talking before the show that we should do podcasts on more TV ones. Maybe we should do them on films.
Do the Carry On films.
Do the Carry On films. Shit!
I'd love that.
How many are there?
Billions.
Oh my God! Maybe. Yeah, I don't know. I think it. Yeah, that could be a film analysis.
31 films.
Fuck! 31 carry-on films.
I think there's one or two that were made in like the 90s, which, you know, like, and there was the very early ones where they hadn't really, because that carry-on style was something that emerged, right? So the very early ones don't actually feel like carry-on.
That's insane.
They were so popular. This is what I mean. Like, they were in the 50s, 60s, 70s, when the working class was a thing that had a self. Had a class consciousness. They engaged with work. You know, this was working class culture. You know, not to say that upper class people wouldn't watch them or anything, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. So the latest one is Carry On Columbus at 1992, and the first one was Carry On Sergeant in 1958.
Yeah.
Hang on, do they still have the same cast?
I think the very early ones, and obviously the 90s ones had different cast, but like the whole middle, like the middle, probably like 20. Had you know, at least 90% the same cast, and it was these things were, I think this is interesting as well, I've not like done the research to back this up, but I would say in the, because the Carry On films had gay men being overtly gay, like they read as gay, right? They might be playing a heterosexual character, some of them might be heterosexual actors, but they're certainly portraying they're intentionally being read as gay, and that was accepted, might have been overlooked, you know, certain circumstances. And I think you get that in the highbrow as well. It's okay to be, you know, at that time, okay to be gay, highbrow, okay to be gay, lowbrow, but middlebrow can't have the gays there because it's all middle class and uncomfortable, you know.
So the highest rated one is only 6.8 on IMDb. Carry On Highbrow.
That's the highest rated one?
Yeah.
The one with people in blackface and shit, I think.
Uh-oh.
That's not the best. That is not the best one.
It's what IMDb says. Not by a huge amount, but...
What are the next couple?
The next couple are... Well, I noticed that that Carry On Camping was there.
That's good.
Well, that's classic, because there's like a... I'm going to look at the trivia one here. Because it's like, was it like the first time boobs were on TV or something like that?
May well be, yeah.
It's something in that ballpark that it was like, Barbara Windsor was like, yeah, she's like the first person to have boobs on TV or some sort of similar kind of like.
I do. I remember being in the school playground at age like 7 or whatever, like to watch Carry On Camping. And like, yeah. Did you see the tits? Yeah. You know, pre-internet as a 7-year-old.
I'd love to know the decision to make that plunge.
I mean, they became, because the very early ones are just sort of gentle comedies, I would say. They're sort of work, they're what we'd call workplace comedies. And then they did sort of lean into that risque double entendre kind of humor, like very hard.
The lowest rated one was
the 90s one, Olga.
No, Carry On Emmanuel.
Oh yeah, I don't think they really count that, because Emmanuel was a soft porn thing, and so towards the end of when all they really had to lean on, when people weren't really watching them anymore, was just, you know, they were titillating, so they leaned into the soft porn aspect crossover with.
Oh, okay.
I'd say the Emmanuel was. Now, what's the lowest rated non-Emmanuel one and not the 90s?
Okay, so yeah, the 90s one is the next lowest. Carry On England is that one, and that's from 1976 at 4 stars out of 10.
they did get worse, yeah, into the late 70s. Yeah.
Do you have a favourite? Oh, Carry On Spider.
I think I have a few. I really like the very, not the earliest ones, but the ones where they were just sort of finding their form, and it was a bit gentler with the risque stuff. I like, so Carry On Cruising, I think. There's one on a ship, anyway. Mm-hmm. And then I think the peak one, the ones that are peak Carry On, you know, what we think of when we think of Carry On, Carry On Camping. Carry On Screaming, that one's peak. I've not watched most of it for a very long time, but I rewatched Carry On Camping a couple of weeks ago. I was just thinking, the world should know about these songs. They're fun. And they're very British. British in a way that I actually enjoy, whereas I hate the Britishness of. To me, like Doctor Who and like Blue Peter and all, you know, all that shit. It's very Southern feeling. It's very middle class feeling, and it's very Protestant feeling. And
it's BBC. It's very BBC.
Yeah,
you know, it's that.
Yeah. Yeah, and as a working class Northern, you know, Midlands Northern Catholic kid, I just felt alienated by that stuff.
I know what you. The BBC stuff, it kind of irks me a little bit as well. Like, it's that. I don't want to say like the one that hit me with that BBC middle classy stuff the most was I went to see in the cinema the film about Richard III with Alan Partridge, but they put Alan Partridge in as a secondary character just so they'd have a name on the bill. But it was the one where it was the recent film about them digging up the remains of it was Richard III that they dug up in the and one of the things, it was done by Pathé, and they. And it's
a documentary.
No, not a documentary. It's a dramatization. Well, not a drama.
Right.
It's not hugely dramatic.
Oh, okay. Like, of the events surrounding the archaeological dig. Yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah.
The discovery, all that kind of. I don't know if it was necessary. I don't know how accurate it was. But the thing is, the Pathé, the production company, their sound mixing is so grating to me in ways that it doesn't seem to be to anyone else. Like, there
are. You were going to say so great.
No, they were horrible. It was horrible. Like, it makes things. The thing that I particularly irks me about it is that it makes things that are quiet in real life loud for the purposes of atmosphere. So,
how do you mean? Like, an example?
There'll be like background noises or atmospheric noises, and they'll massively raise the volume.
That's a thing that came out of like indie and stuff.
The indie rising to BBC kind of.
Yesterday we watched a film called Don't Worry, Darling, which is really a retelling of the Stepford Wives from the 70s. That's a great film, by the way, Stepford Wives. But it's got this the main character is paranoid and tense, you know, it's trying to communicate tension. So it does that thing of elevating background noise and breathing and stuff like that, elevating it to serve the purpose of making you feel tense, which I think is what that is for. And I think that's when it's correctly.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah. So, anyway, we've rattled on for a while, haven't we? I've just like clocked the time. Is there anything we want to talk? Anything else we want to talk about?
Well, finish what you're saying about the sound mix. That, Richard. That sounds interesting to me. Why didn't you like it?
Because it was like it was jarring. It was just It's like,
was it an over modern presentation? Like an overly, were they trying too hard? Basically,
yeah. There's definitely a trying too hardness about it. It's like they're desperately trying to foster
vibe. I get it. This is culturally elevated, and you should feel culturally elevated for watching it, kind of thing, rather than just like, here's what happened.
It's quite subtle, and it's just in the sound mixing, and you see it on a few films, a few TV, you see it a lot on TV programs. I think actually, now that you mention it, I think that it might actually kind of be an indie studio kind of thing, because you see it a lot on Welsh television too.
Time team. distinctly middle brow.
Is Time Team distinctly middle brow?
Yeah, because it's like, because you watch it and like you feel clever for watching it, but it's not actually that clever.
Well, they're just digging up remains, right? I mean,
it's... Yeah. But it's like, you know, you got these professors from Oxford telling you, oh, this was this historical, but they never, they're not actually doing history. They're just like telling you things. They're not doing anything clever fundamentally. It's got the feeling of being elevated and educational, and you know, the kind of thing that like a middle class family sits down to watch on a Sunday evening kind of thing. But it's not, you're not really learning it. You're learning, you know, if learning dates and facts is history, then yeah, but it's not.
What about Watercolor Challenge? Is that middle brow?
I would say that's low brow. Very enjoyably low brow.
Low brow?
It's got a very trash feel.
What? Watercolor Challenge?
Well, I know. The subject matter is a bit elevated, but like it's reality TV. It's scheduled when unemployed people and students are watching TV, which is when I watched it religiously because it was fucking great. But yeah, no, I think it's got some highbrow motifs, but I think it's lowbrow because it's honest.
What about Ready Steady Cook?
So enjoyably lowbrow.
Yeah, I do like Ready. I did like Ready Steady Cook when it was on. Is it still on?
I don't know. Yeah. It's one of those things that I loved. I loved it back in the day, but I'm only going to watch it now. Okay, I had my fill of it.
Yeah, but also a lot of that stuff back then was designed for TV, which doesn't necessarily automatically translate on demand, which I realized when I went to binge The Crystal Maze, which then I realized that actually it's basically the same thing every single fucking week with different people.
Yeah, we watch something like that and one episode is enough.
Yeah.
Like you're sated. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Reality TV, I guess, in general, or, you know, game showy stuff.
Yeah. Cool. All right, should we
wrap up?
Yeah, let's wrap up.
What the fuck was this about? What were we going to call
it? Like, it's going to be
mostly flags.
It's mostly flags, but Fediverse stuff at the beginning, I guess. So
we started with Mozilla and very quickly went into flags.
Ah, well.
We didn't even say anything about Mozilla.
Oh, right, yeah.
Because I've moved back to Firefox, and it is very much despite Mozilla, as somebody put it on Fedi, despite Mozilla rather than because of Mozilla. But I've turned off all the AI stuff, obviously. But anyway. We can discuss.
Is there actually AI stuff in your Firefox?
Well, I immediately when I installed it, I immediately turned it off, so I've not seen it. But yeah, I think it's you can do a summary thing, and Google's put it in now as well. I know Google have got there, but you know it's in the search results at the top now, so you've got to scroll past the AI slot before you can get to even the shitty results as they are now.
Well, I use here's one we could is a tech topic we can finish on. I have been trying out Mojang. Oh no, hang on a minute. No, I think I might have covered this in the previous one.
Mojang, no, we did. Yeah, using, we talked about it. Yeah.
But now I've switched back to DuckDuckGo because Mojang's image search was not very good at all.
Right. Really
not usable at all. Its main results like a fine if you know what you're looking for, if you've got an idea. Sometimes, like, I've Googled, like, for a recipe or something, and it's not too bad because it's got a lot of, like, indie sites on it. So it's quite good. So it kind of sits in a weird place of, like, if I'm looking for something on that's not on one of the big websites, Mojang's actually quite good at that kind of thing.
Yeah, maybe we're going back to different search engines for different kind of, like, if I want to know when an act was born, I'll go to Google. But if I want to specifically recipe from an indie thing, then
I've gone back to DuckDuckGo as my usual one because I don't know if it's because like you learn to speak a language with the search engine where it's like terms or you know how to order them, because I find DuckDuckGo works well enough for me, but then I've spent years learning the DuckDuckGo sort of lingo and
Yeah, that's honestly, as a casual user of DuckDuckGo, I pride it now and then. The results are good enough, and as Google results get worse and worse, they're probably going to cross over at some point.
Yeah, but also you don't get the AI at the top. Although, because it gives you some things, like it'll give you a dictionary definition or it'll give you a Wikipedia thing. That's all you need, right?
Like, yeah.
It's the fact that, like, I'm going to be interested to see with all this AI stuff, like, what's going to be, like, the first big catastrophe that it causes. It's caused a few small catastrophes.
Like
the time when they was it someone tried to write up a legal brief with ChatGPT.
Oh, Jesus.
They got in big fucking trouble. Yeah.
Oh.
So, but like, that's like the biggest AI disaster I've seen so far. But I don't know. I imagine there's going to be one in the pipeline where AI does something unimaginably.
Unless like, we all just get used to slow, again, Idiocracy. Maybe everybody uses it, and we're just used to everything. Everything is like 20% wrong all the time.
But the thing about AI is that it doesn't like all of its current uses. But there are obviously with the language model, it's not too bad at actual language stuff, right? Like I've asked ChatGPT to read over work and point out grammatical errors, not to change it, but to like and mark my work and that kind of thing. It is kind of okay for things like summary and stuff like that. It's quite good for like menial tasks as well. Like if you've got a big piece of text and you want to be like, okay, I want to switch every comma with every colon with a comma or something like that. Find an automated task like that. It does present an easy solution. But other than those like small use cases, what's the real benefit? Like, I know that they're trying to like tout this idea that you may be able to replace workers with them, but if someone needs to be responsible for their work, then you've got the work, but you've got no one or nothing to sign it off, as it were. Like,
I think that will work because, you know, a lot of people, especially sort of office work, a lot of people don't actually do a ton of work. Mm. And sort of accuracy, that kind of accuracy, there's certainly jobs where that kind of accuracy doesn't really matter that much, probably. So if you could have like, you know, five people who work 10% of the time replaced by an AI and then one person who oversees it and just check that, you know, that probably happened. But is it worth, because it's going to get more expensive because it's using a shit ton of energy. Like, as soon as it's, you know, same as everything, as soon as it's ubiquitous, they'll start actually properly charging for it. And it's probably going to be one of those things like the cloud. You know, everybody went to the cloud because it's cheaper. We can save you, you know, we can save your organization, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands or whatever by moving to the cloud. And everybody's in the cloud and everybody's captive and they raise the prices. And now everybody's going back to, you know, hosting their own, or, you know, companies going back to hosting their own servers and stuff. And I can imagine it being a bit like that. Yeah. Companies might embrace it and then goes up and they're like, oh right, it'd be cheaper to hire people back. And, you know, there's a lot of like tech that seems to be tech at the moment. Capture something by, well, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. Like I think at the same time, like I think it's a bubble. It's already like
does seem to be a bubble.
Slowing down. And I think it's simply down to the like I think it's finding its place because I don't think it's going to disappear. I've seen uses
for it.
But
is it going to be given the sort of energy cost and can you just computing cost and you know, the costs associated with it, is it going to be worth having it for those very small tasks? Like if it can't do the... I was going to say earlier, like it does, I think, you know, that kind of AI, that kind of neural network, what they call combative models, something like that. It can be very good. As an example I heard years ago, like, you know, like if public transport was nationally owned and nationally run, you could use it to optimize routes. It could look at things in a way that's like far too, you know, informationally dense for a human to do. And it could say like, if we tweak these buses by this many minutes and these trains by blah, blah, everything will just meet up a bit better. Like optimizing stuff. Like when do people actually travel versus when, you know, those kinds of problems. It's probably quite good at that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But because those things aren't, you know, centrally nationally managed or nationally run, we don't have those kind of applications to put it. So it's put to, yeah, you know.
But I've seen like
it could have been a very useful thing.
Yeah. Well, I've seen people use it in like health research and stuff like that. And I don't know how. It's well beyond my knowledge base to know how. But apparently, like it can. I don't know. I don't even know if this falls into the language model part of AI or whether or not it's doing something else. Mm-hmm. But I occasionally hear stories about things like, oh, you know, AI has helped. You know,
yeah, it's very good at, I might not put this in, you know, terms that a computer scientist would be happy with, but it's adversarial neural networks, isn't it? Those are very good at optimizing that have very well-defined constraints. And like public transport would be a good example of that, but like refining sort of design things, that, you know, more engineering, I guess, things that have very particular constraints and finding ways of doing that a human wouldn't think of. I think for those kind of things, it does. Yeah, I think it's going to be valuable for that kind of thing.
And you can self-host as well. Like we can self-host now. There's a thing. It's on one of my previous videos, Jan.ai.
But you can't. Yeah, but then you're taking a model and applying it to generate the model. You need super powerful computers that consume a shit ton of energy. But then you can run things through that model on a local Yeah.
Well, the model has been generated, though, isn't it? Well, there are models. So, I mean, it does use the. I think one of the issues with doing it locally is that it requires quite a lot. Like my little B-Link just fires right up when I'm doing any. And it's not as good as ChatGPT because obviously the computer is tiny and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But for the kind of tasks that I'd need it for, it's fine. But
I mean, that's why that does seem to be where Mozilla was going. Yeah, having the model be local.
But I think that I think that the average person day to day use of it, nah. Like
I read a post by somebody who's saying they don't want their work summarized, you know, either read my work and experience it as it was intended or don't summarize, you know, essentially that was what they were saying. And I agree with that. I find it a bit insulting to me as a, you know, as a human being with a soul and intelligence and an imagination to say to me that, no, you need things summarizing. You don't want to actually experience anything. You just want the fucking bullet points. And that, to me, that's insulting to humanity a little bit.
I mean, it depends. Yeah, but like, I mean, with art, I get that. But if you're reading a boring document, that you know,
yeah, but the problem is capitalism. The problem is that somebody has a job to do. Like, that's a bad job. Don't give people that job.
I mean, does the fact that people need to summarize it is that really a mistake of the author not making it?
Exactly. Well, yeah, I saw a cartoon. This is a bit of a trope, isn't it? On freebooters, we say cartoons in words, but on one side there's somebody saying, "I sent this email. I just gave ChatGPT a bullet point, and it wrote, you know, it wrote me a long email based on my bullet point and sent it to this other person." And the second frame was this person saying, "I received this long email, and I just got ChatGPT to summarize it as a bullet point." You know, so
yeah, that's it. You know, yeah exactly.
Like, yeah, that's.
And I'm getting more and more worried that people will start using GPT to basically pad out stuff.
I worry
that we're gonna I worry that we're entering a world of padding because one of the hallmarks of ChatGPT is that it adds words into a sentence that it thinks make the sentence
longer. Yeah, I think a lot of tasks, you know, in university where you're tasked with writing an essay, and rather than the teacher going, you know, the essay is as long as it is. Mm. If you're writing about this topic, explore this topic fully, and then the essay is however long it is, they'll go, you know, it's got to be 11 pages or whatever. Mm. And I think for some reason that seems to extend into the work world. Like people will pad their own work because they feel like, oh, I don't feel like I've done a proper job if it was only, you know, and then, yeah, and then that's, like the cartoon. So you got on one hand, people padding, and then the other hand is people summarizing. Let's maybe get rid of that problem rather than solve it with AI.
Yeah. And
you know, information availability, if we need more readily digestible information about certain kinds of things in order to function correctly, then make that available rather than, you know.
Yeah, but of course that's not the world we live in, and to translate one to the other.
Is that in large part because the world is mediated to us by, you know, the news media or whatever. You know, if you want, that's where people get, for example, you know, that's, you know, unless they're particularly interested or specialized, like we get our scientific education from the media. It's very bad at that. Mm. I don't really know. I forgot my point. So again, getting rid of the need for the summarization and let's do that better.
Yeah, I did sort of recognize that impulse in myself quite early on and did decide to realize, actually, if something's short, I'll make it short.
Because
the thing is, it's like, if you write something long, people will read that and maybe remember about 20% of it.
But yeah,
the goal is like, just write the 20% that people are going to remember. That's sort of where I go, is like,
yeah,
you know, and graphics and props and all that help, but I sort of put the kibosh on padding stuff out very early on, because in university I used to do a fair amount of padding, and it was like, you know, most of my lecturers were like, look, if you know, like it should be as long as it is, but in reality, I don't know if it was a university thing or an expectations thing or something, but it's like, it's 10% either way of the word limit, which I guess doesn't make it a word limit if you can go 10% either way. But,
yeah.
you know, a 10% either way on the word limit of 1,000 words is just like it's a word limit of 1,100.
Yeah, words. I'd rather again, you know, like hippy dippy or whatever. But like, I'd rather that, like, if they say, you know, no word limit, just write it to the length. Then, you know, if somebody writes one that's far too long and somebody writes one that's far too short, then the tutor has a word with you and say, like, you know, this needed more. Your essay about this should be a bit longer. Your essay should be a bit shorter. That's something that's negotiated rather than, you know.
I think a lot of it depends on like the expectations of detail, right? Like if one of my assignments long ago was talking about the low voter turnout among black people in the American elections, you know, and sort of the whys and wherefores of that. And I could have just said historic racism, you know, I could have done a paragraph. I could have done 2,000 words on, you know, gerrymandering and voter suppression.
Yeah.
All that kind of stuff. So I guess it's, that's really what.
Well, again, that's the job of the tutor to, you know, calibrate your idea of how much detail is expected. That's, yeah.
Although to be fair, I think it makes more sense in academia than it does in the real world. In the real world.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, things are less hypothetical. So, and to be honest, in the real world, people don't read that much anyway, so shorter is almost always better.
I get a lot of emails from, you know, if I'm doing something procedural, dealing with somebody where we have to exchange information, and everybody feels the need to pad out emails, you know, good morning, how are you doing, blah, blah, blah. And you don't read that, you skim that, and then get to the actual bit with the information that you wanted, right? But then you'll do the same in return, I hope you're having a good day, and blah, blah.
So I think ChatGPT could lead us down this road into padding. Not even necessarily text from ChatGPT itself, but it could be it melds into our culture and we just become more linguistically meandering.
You know how autotune was invented and then it was used to correct, you know, singing to make it more how it was supposed, and then people started enjoying the aesthetic of autotune, and then you got an aesthetic of things being very heavily auto-tuned, like the auto-tune became the thing. I wonder whether, in 20 years' time, we'll have people writing novels, like, trying to emulate the style of ChatGPT.
That'd be...
Like, intentional plot holes, and, you know, like, but craft, not exactly what Chat, you know, an affectation.
Anyway, we're gonna wrap up 20 minutes.
Yes, that's, yeah. But, good luck, Tom. Come on.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Thanks for joining us. Comments, as always, they're the ones we want. And we'll see you in the next one. Toodaloo.
Bye-bye.